Coming up Sunday morning at 9 on Hometown Heroes, you might see this 94-year-old still driving his way around Bakersfield. But on June 6, 1944, he was on the battleship Texas at Omaha Beach.
Germans were just knocking them off right and left. It was really a bloody mess.
Find out what else he witnessed there at Normandy and throughout his service in World War II on Hometown Heroes. Sunday morning at 9 on 1560 AM and 97.7 FM KNZR.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done things that it's kind of hard to believe sometimes for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for that freedom we enjoy every day. And along the way, we sure are educated. We're often entertained and even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today, we're going to hear from a 94-year-old, still driving, still in great shape, and you'll get a taste of his personality over the next hour. Willis Shepherd of Bakersfield, California, originally, though, from Huron, South Dakota. What was it like in Huron, South Dakota in the 20s and 30s growing up?
Well, we had hot summers and cold winters. That's about and it was a pretty nice country, all pretty much agriculture. I lived on a farm myself and was born and raised on a farm, and so I went to country school and grammar school, and it's good life.
Now, when you say hot in the summers and cold in the winters, I'm guessing folks in Bakersfield here or anywhere in California really don't know quite how cold you're talking about. What's the coldest you remember there on the plains of South Dakota?
Oh, probably 12 below zero. And in the summertime, it got over 100, sometimes 105. We had cows to milk, and I worked in a drove tractor when I was 6 years old. I went from the schoolhouse to the tractor and drove tractor until dark in the summer during harvest and seeding time.
You said 6 years old?
Yep, 6 years old.
That's great. And what kind of crops did you guys grow?
Oh, we had corn and wheat and barley and oats. And then we had sugar cane. For those dry years, we planted sugar cane. We had several dry years in the 30s and with lack of rain, and we didn't have irrigation. We depended on the clouds to take care of us.
I know that's a long time ago, but do you remember what kind of ambitions you had as a young man? I mean, did you think about going somewhere else besides South Dakota? What did you envision for yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't too happy on the farm. I mean, I was happy driving tractor and things like that, but I didn't think that was going to be my livelihood for the rest of my life.
And how was it that you ended up in California?
My uncle was a plumbing and heating contractor in Carmel, and advised me to come out, and he trained me in one of the other crafts. It was had electrical also. So I started out as an apprentice electrician.
And so that's where you were, the Monterey Peninsula, when you got that news that everyone seems to remember, who was alive on December 7th, 1941?
Yeah, I was in Carmel at the time. And after about a month later, I went to San Diego with two or three other guys, and we went to work for Consolidated Aircraft building B-24s. And I worked there about a year before I went in the Navy.
That day, December 7th, 41, you're 21 years old. You're, you know, obviously busy in this exciting new career, an exciting place to be out here in California. When you heard that news, do you remember how you found out and what it meant to you?
I heard it over the radio through my aunt and uncle. Matter of fact, I was outside washing my car at the at that particular time, and that's the way I heard it over the radio.
Did it mean anything to you? I mean, was it real to you? Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before, or was this some faraway place that didn't matter too much to you?
Oh, I had heard of it, but I wasn't that familiar with it, and it was a very big surprise to me. I knew it was the starting of a war when they came in there and bombed all those ships, so it was time to get in the service and do your chore.
And I've heard some stories from people who lived on California's coastline at that time that there was a real fear of the Japanese attacking the coast of California. In fact, they fired a few shells out by Santa Barbara. Did you guys have to live any differently in Carmel in the wake of that news?
Well, as a matter of fact, we did live a little different. They turned out the lights. They advised us to put blackouts on our windows. They just didn't want the Japanese to land in anywhere on the coast. So it was a little bit scary.
So you go down to San Diego and you're working on these B-24s. What part of the assembly line was your station? What were you doing on those planes?
I worked on the nose part of the B-24. I was an electrician and did wiring in the nose and the cockpit area.
That sounds like a lot of responsibility, because if you don't wire it quite right, then it's not going to work quite right, huh?
Well, we had inspectors, so they checked us out.
And was it impressive to see how quickly those planes could be turned out? I mean, how so many people working together could keep those coming out of that factory?
Well, they had a home plant and a parts plant. I worked in a parts plant. They made different sections of it, of the plane, and then they took it down in the home plant and assembled it there. So I'm not sure how many planes they put out in a day or how long it took, but it was pretty well organized.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you were working in that position that was vital to the defense industry, you could have had an exemption from getting in uniform and going overseas, couldn't you?
Oh, as a matter of fact, I did get one. But I got to the point where I wanted to get in the service and do my chore in there.
What do you think it was that made you say, yeah, I want to go do more than I'm already doing?
Well, I just felt that I should do my part in the service, so I just quit my job and joined the Navy.
What made you choose the Navy? Was it just being in San Diego and that was the only way to go? I mean, they had the Marines up the road there, too. What about the Navy attracted you?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was going to join the Marines, and I, at that particular time, why all the training camps were full, and they weren't taking any more guys, so they told me to go to San Francisco. Maybe I could join up there. So my mother still lived in Carmel, so I went up to Carmel to see her, and then I went to Salinas. They had recruiting stations over there, so I went down to the Marine, and it was the same thing down there. So I just went to the Navy then, and I was sent practically the next day to Farragut, Idaho, where I went through boot camp.
Well, I'm sure there was nothing in Farragut, Idaho that could have surprised a guy from South Dakota, huh?
No, it was a nice area. Farragut, Idaho was a nice area, real nice. I spent 6 weeks there. We were put on a troop train, and I went to Norfolk, Virginia, and that's where I went aboard the Texas.
The USS Texas, for those who aren't familiar with how ships are designated and which ones get the states and which ones get the cities and how big they are and all that, tell us what kind of ship the Texas was and what your impressions of it were.
Oh, Texas was a battleship, and it was an old ship. It was built in 1913, and it didn't have the air conditioning facilities on it like the newer ships did. So when we got down in the South Pacific, why, we went through a lot of hot temperatures down there and humid.
What were your duties on the ship?
I was a boat's mate. I stood a deck officer with a regular officer aboard the gangway. And anybody coming or leaving the ship had to check with us before they could do so. And then I was regular duty. We had what we called the air castle, and that was our cleaning facilities. And general quarters, I was on a 5-inch gun. We had about 1,800 men on our ship, so it was like a small city.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, 1,800 men on that ship, how many people you think you had in Huron, South Dakota growing up?
I think we only had about 10,000.
So not too far off. Did you find that you made pretty quick friendships with those guys on the ship? What was that atmosphere like?
Oh, you make friends with just about anybody, because we had 105 men in an area probably 20 foot square. We had bunks five high, and then we had cots and hammocks. So you make friends with just about anybody.
Well, I'm sure you had a lot of friends if you were the deck officer, because they all wanted to be on good terms with you if they wanted to get off. Every veteran that I've talked to seems to have a moment that was the, well, welcome to the war. This is real. This is not some idea or fantasy anymore. This is real life, and it's not pretty. What was that moment for you where you got that first taste of what war's really like?
Well, my first real taste was Normandy, invasion of Normandy. And, of course, we were in England before we landed troops in Normandy. And, of course, General Eisenhower came aboard our ship before we went to Normandy. And we knew that this was going to be for real. And it was scary.
And had you been kind of hearing rumblings before that you guys were going to be going across that channel at some point?
No, it was pretty... pretty tight-lipped. Nobody knew anything. Matter of fact, we didn't know it until that morning, really. We left England in the dark, probably about 4 o'clock in the morning. In time we got across the channel, I started getting a little bit daylight. It was scary. I watched, we watched, the landing crafts taking soldiers ashore, and Germans were just knocking them off right and left, and it was really a bloody mess for some time.
Well, and I want to talk to you more about that, but I'm sure some people's ears perked up too when you mentioned General Eisenhower. And I've heard the speech that was broadcast on D-Day to all the troops around there. But what did he say on your ship? And what do you remember about that moment? I'm sure there are a lot of guys paying very close attention.
Well, he was aware of how many men and ships and was involved and going to be involved. And of course he told us about what we could expect as far as being challenged for our life. And he said that this is going to be a big movement, and it's one of the biggest invasions in history. So he just led us to believe that it was a challenge.
I think if I remember his speech right, that was broadcast that day anyway, I think he said something about, today we embark on a great crusade. Did it feel like a crusade to you? I mean, did you feel like this was going to be a historic moment, that this was a big deal you were part of?
Well, he led me to believe that it was going to be life or death. So it was a crusade as far as I was concerned.
And you had been a little shy of your 24th birthday, so considering life and death at that age and that situation, what does that do for a guy? How did that make you feel?
It was scary, very scary. I didn't know what to expect when we were going across the channel. It was dark and planes flying around, and then of course when we got close to France, everything what exploded then. Bombs, and then we started firing, knocking out gun emplacements, and then we were put on a line to knock out railroads so they couldn't bring more equipment and troops in. So we had a big job to do, like everybody else did.
Well, and you mentioned everybody else, and that of all the guys that I've talked to that had a hand in that D-Day invasion, if I talk to guys that were in the Air Corps, they talk about how many planes were in the sky and if they could actually see the channel, how it looked like they could walk across on all the ships. And you mentioned it being dark and then, you know, the sun coming up. When the sun came up and you looked around, could you believe what you saw just in terms of the size of the force that was there?
It was scary. There were so many ships and so many planes that I just had a feeling that we were going to make it through, because I didn't think the Germans were that much fortified. So they had these gun emplacements, and they were kind of dome-shaped concrete, and the planes were dropping bombs on them, and they just the bombs would ricochet off of them when they open them up. And so they brought, we came in there with our 14-inch guns and from the side and just blew them open. We wore our 14-inch guns out over there. And when, matter of fact, when we got back to the States, they took one of our 14-inch guns and put it on a big trailer and had a war bonds drive going down Broadway in New York City.
Yeah, that's that gun had a little history to it. And while that's all going on, were you at that 5-inch gun firing away?
Yeah. Of course, we were all at general quarters, and we were all firing. That's where I lost my hearing is from those 14-inch guns practically right over my head.
And I know it's you can probably still hear it in your head. Most of us have never experienced it, and Lord willing, never will experience something like that. What does that sound and feel like, and how long does it last when you're in a moment like that?
Well, it probably lasted probably 30 minutes at least. Maybe it's hard to visualize now. Maybe it was an hour and a half. I don't know. It was a long time. We had anti-flash gear on and life jackets and all that, but you still get that boom blasting. So it was tough.
Something tells me I'm not the only one thinking tough might be an understatement. Time to catch a break, but we're going to explore more of Willis Shepherd's D-Day experience when we come back. We'll also talk about the more recent adventure he had with Honor Flight Kern County. And before we're done, I'll tell you about the winner of our contest for tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood. He's just a teenager, and I'm going to read you his winning entry. Much more to come when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you've listened to the show for a while, you've probably heard parts or all of General Dwight Eisenhower's famous D-Day address at one point or another.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
That's a little bit of what everybody heard on June 6, 1944, but a couple of weeks earlier, Eisenhower was on the battleship Texas in Belfast. You heard our guest Willis Shepherd describe the speech that Eisenhower gave and what it meant to him. And one of the things I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page is a transcript of that speech aboard the USS Texas on May 19th, 1944. Before we get back to Mr. Shepherd's memories, let me read that speech to you. And imagine yourself as Mr. Shepherd or one of those other sailors aboard this historic battleship. The general begins, "No man could be more honored than I in the opportunity to come out here this morning and on this ship, which by coincidence is named after the state of my birth, to welcome here into the great Allied team that has been operating in the European theater for the past 18 months, the officers and men of the ships that have come to bear their part in the beginning of the real attack on Axis Europe. I assure you that standing here this morning, there is not only the pride of an American and a great institution, one of which we are so proud at home, but I think I have the feeling that here in these mighty ships and in their crews, there is with me once and for all in this thing the might and tradition of the United States Navy, coupled up with similar forces of His Majesty's Navy, and that there is a support that has come to me that makes me feel better than I have in the 18 long months. I am truly thrilled. The textbooks that most of your senior officers have followed as they have gone through the services say that the high commander should go down and inspect the troops in order to inspire them and in order to impress his personality upon them. In my case, I must be a throwback or monkey or something is wrong because I always carry back to my own desk a thrill and inspiration that comes only when I get to see the fighting men. Because this is one thing I would like all of you to remember. There are limitations in war upon what the high command can do. Admiral Kirk has given me some credit for getting these United States ships here. Well, I certainly argued and cursed enough about it, but after all, that is just getting them over. The high command can get you the supplies, can make sure of your preparations, it can make sure that your air coverage is present, because in the next battle we are going into, we are going in with the greatest air coverage that has ever accompanied you and your forces in history. They provide for taking care of you when wounded. They see that you are disposed properly, that your guns are turned on the right targets, but my God, men, you do the fighting. No general or any other person in high capacity really fires the shots that knocks out the enemy batteries and sinks the ships. You are the people who do it. You are the man handling the guns and turrets, the man handling the firing of the weapons, torpedoes, Bofors, everything. You are the men who are winning the war. You have come to do it, and all we can do is see that everything is made ready. And then you, with your American courage, your American indomitable will to win, have got to be at your best. Knock that Hitler out of the war. Yours is the job, and you are the men that the United States is going to be proud of. God bless you all, and good luck go with every one of you. Let me tell you, the feeling that you are in there pitching with us is a great one for me as I contemplate the great day. Those are the words, the complete remarks of General Dwight Eisenhower to Willis Shepard and 1,800 other sailors aboard the USS Texas before that Normandy invasion. We heard a little bit of Mr. Shepard's D-Day memories, a few of the things he saw from aboard the Texas at Omaha Beach, and we heard him say he lost his hearing because of those giant 14-inch guns firing up above him. But Mr. Shepard, you said you were on a 5-inch gun, and just to educate everybody here, how many men does it take to man one of those 5-inch guns on the deck of this battleship?
There was six guys. There was a trainer and a pointer, and then we had muzzle loaders and ammunition passers, and probably five or six guys.
And did you have to know all of those roles, or what did you do specifically?
I was a trainer on a 5-inch gun. That's all taken care of by one system of, not a radar, but sort of like radar. And you just train the gun to match their equipment.
So you're looking at a mechanism that is talking about range and left, right, up and down, and getting into the right spot.
Right.
And did you have much of an understanding of what the result of those projectiles was, what kind of damage you guys were doing, or if you were hitting the right spot?
Well, yeah, they announced over the speaker system that whenever they tore up gun emplacements or things like that. We went into Cherbourg after this was three or four days after the landing. We were about 3 miles out, and they started shooting, firing 11.6 shells at us. And we had two direct hits and 65 near misses. And one shell came in and hit the top of the conning tower. And, of course, the bridge is right above that. And it just tore the bridge up. And we were out of control there for a little while. And then we had to go to England then and get repairs and get more supplies and stuff. And then we came back, or we left there and... After we got fixed up, and then we went left there and went back down to southern France and did a little shooting, firing down there.
And forgive me for bouncing around a little bit here, but I'm sure a lot of people have asked you, when they hear where you were on June 6, 1944, they probably want to know about it. And so much has been said and written about that day, the longest day. Did it feel like the longest day to you? Did it seem like it was never going to end?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I felt sorry for the landing troops. They really took a beating when they went in there. Of course, it was the current was bad, and there was waves, and they ended up sinking about three or four, or maybe it was more than that, old Liberty ships for a breakwater. They just sunk the ships and for breakwater so they could get supplies and stuff and men in there. So it worked out. They was well organized.
And I know it's not easy to think about this, but what are the things that you saw that you can still see in your mind today that very few people have ever seen? Can you kind of paint that picture for when you had time to look out to your left, to your right, and straight ahead, what you actually saw?
Well, the landing crafts were going in there with the men. I could see from where we were, guys Germans were just knocking them off and killing them, a lot of guys before they even hit the beach. But after we started knocking out some of those gun emplacements, why, it got a lot better then. And they were landing, coming in there with probably no problem after that.
And of course, 30 years ago, President Reagan gave that speech over there and so famously drew attention to one little aspect of it, those Rangers that were scaling the cliffs at Point Du Hoc there. Did you see where that was or see any of that going on?
Only pictures of it, yeah. I would have liked to have gone over there. Matter of fact, I'd still like to go over there and see what it's like today. I kind of wonder if they ever raise those ships or whatever they did with those old Liberty ships.
Yes, they called them block ships, and it was a long, secretly planned project to create that breakwater. They put floating concrete structures above them, and you can still see remnants of that artificial harbor if you visit Normandy today. I haven't had that privilege of visiting Normandy, but those who have often talk about the cemeteries, very moving and emotional places. And it makes me wonder, when did it hit you, the magnitude of it all, the number of lives lost there, and did you lose any off your ship?
Yeah, there was several men killed on the bridge when that shell hit the conning tower. The other shell that we got hit with came through the side in an officer's room and didn't explode, but we were lucky there.
This is a weird question, I guess. Because you still have a war to fight and you're going on to these other spots, and I want to talk about some of the other things you experienced. But was there a point during or after the war where you realized, you know, that day, June 6th, was a gigantic day in world history and the world changed a lot in that one day that you were a part of?
Yeah, I also realized all these islands in the Pacific that were taken over from the Japanese were just as important as Normandy, but Normandy was just a bigger project than any one of the islands. We went to the Pacific after Normandy and went through the canal and went to Iwo Jima invasion and Okinawa invasion, and we were in the Philippines when the war ended, when the Japanese surrendered. That was a hallelujah day.
I bet, and I want to hear about it. That must have been an adventure, though, for you, to go from the Atlantic through this Panama Canal and back to the other side. I mean, talk about seeing both ends of something and both ends of the spectrum. What do you remember about that journey?
Our worst part of the Pacific was the suicide planes. We didn't get hit with any of them, but we shot down some of them at very close range to the ship.
Was that at Okinawa?
Well, at Okinawa and Iwo Jima both.
Iwo Jima came first before Okinawa. What was the duty of your ship? Were you guys just off the shore shelling?
Yeah, we shelled Iwo Jima probably 2 days before they landed troops there. It was a small island, but we poured a lot of lead in there, but it kind of softened up the troops a little bit. But they hung tight because they lost a lot of men there in Iwo Jima.
Yeah, and of course, someone hears Iwo Jima, they think of that maybe the most famous photograph of all of World War II, of the flag going up atop Mount Suribachi. And I've talked to a lot of sailors who maybe never even set foot on Iwo Jima, but said they saw that flag flying from their ship. Is that something you experienced?
I saw that flag go up. I was just happened to be looking at Mount Suribachi when that they put that flag up.
Did it mean something to you?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So when you see that photo today, or you see, you know, I know you went back to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Kern County and visited the Marine Corps Memorial, which is a larger-than-life 3D version of that moment. When you see any kind of representation of those guys hoisting that flag, what does it mean to you?
Pretty impressive. I felt like I was right there.
And you mentioned the kamikazes. Was that a helpless feeling when those are coming your way? I mean, to not know if one's going to hit you guys or not?
Well, they were very experienced pilots. They were always trying to attack a troop ship or a larger ship like a cruiser or battleship. They flew real low to the water, and of course there'd be a lot of other ships in the area, and they knew that certain ships couldn't fire at them because they'd liable to hit another ship. So, and they'd flip the wings back and forth, up and down, and I saw a destroyer. I don't remember the name of it, but I saw a destroyer that shot down 17 suicide planes, and the 18th one hit it, and it just leveled it. It was hardly anything above the water.
What's the closest one came to hitting the Texas?
Oh, I'd say probably 150 yards, maybe 300 yards.
And were you ever in a position of trying to shoot one down?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Our 40 millimeters and 20 millimeters were our prime guns for the suicide planes.
So you actually hopped on one of those and tried to shoot one down?
Well, I was on the 5-inch, so we shot at them, but the 40s and the 20s were really the prime guns for suicide planes. We were anchored in a little island called Ulysses. We were only there about a day or two. That was before Iwo Jima, and there was a carrier Randolph was probably a half a mile in front of us. We were up on the forecastle going to go watch a movie, and the suicide plane come in there and hit it. And I saw that ship get hit twice when it was anchored. And another time it was in the Philippines. It was a P-38 doing some control diving and one thing and another, and he must have blacked out because he went right into the flight deck of that Randolph and it was anchored.
When you see that happen, whether it's that little destroyer or that giant carrier, and you see things like that happen to other ships, is there something that says, hey, that might happen to my ship, that might happen to me?
Sure do. You give a lot of thought about it.
And where does it take you? Did you believe that you would survive, that you would get through that?
Oh, I don't know. I felt pretty secure. All our guns and everything were pretty protective, you know. We could just about take care of ourselves. Still, you never know. Those suicides sneak in on you, and anything could happen, you know.
Absolutely. And there was more that happened. We're going to hear about it when we come back. And I'll also ask Mr. Shepherd about his experience with Honor Flight Kern County. Wherever you're listening today, there's an Honor Flight organization ready to fly the World War II veteran in your life free of charge to see the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. If you're like Mr. Shepherd there in the Bakersfield area, Honor Flight Kern County's next trip is almost here. If you want to help send veterans off from the Bakersfield Airport, they're going to be leaving early in the morning on Thursday, August 21st, and you can welcome them home Saturday night, August 23rd. I have a link to that information at hometownheroesradio.com. The rest of Willis Shepherd's story when we come back, and I'm also going to read you something written by someone 80 years younger than Mr. Shepherd. I don't think you want to miss it. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Willis Shepherd of Bakersfield, California. Originally from Huron, South Dakota, he spent nearly half of his life as an electrician in Carmel on the Monterey Peninsula. But during World War II, he was a long way from there. He was on the USS Texas, a battleship that you can actually still visit in Houston. In fact, they just had a big celebration there marking the ship's 100th birthday. If you've seen Clint Eastwood's movies, well, there's another Carmel guy for you. His movies, The Flags of Our Fathers or Letters from Iwo Jima, You've actually seen the USS Texas. She played herself in those two films. Mr. Shepard talked about Iwo Jima, of course, and we heard about his experience on D-Day at Omaha Beach, too. But the last major battle that Texas was involved in was Okinawa in the spring of 1945. What do you remember about that?
Okinawa was also a tough island. It was where a typhoon came in when we were there, and all the ships, or most of the ships anyway, took off and headed for China. Several ships got washed up on the beach there in Okinawa, and so we all got out of there. It was really, we were about 4 days, we couldn't even go on a main deck. It was just, our ship was underwater as much as it was on the top of the water.
Rocking and rolling a little bit?
Oh, yeah. It was tough.
Well, again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and how do you handle a situation like that? Is there anything you can do?
We couldn't eat, set up tables to eat. We had to sit in wherever you could sit and just hold it on your lap because the ship was rolling and pitching, and it was a tough situation for about 4 days.
Were you scared?
Yeah, I was a little scared. I was more scared than normally, though.
Well, and I guess the other thing I should bring up is, I think while all that's going on, especially there in the Pacific later in the war, I think you had a particular motivation for getting back to the States, didn't you? Wasn't there someone you wanted to meet up with again?
Well, yeah. My future wife, I only knew her through my sisters there in Washington, D.C., and I probably only saw her about four different times. I just thought I was going to marry her when I got home.
Tell me how you met.
I had two sisters living in this apartment house, and she lived in there, and same apartment house, and they introduced me to her, and I don't know, I fell for her the minute I saw her. Thought, well, someday I'm going to marry her, and I did.
That was during the war that you were through Washington, D.C. and met her?
Yeah, it was during the war when I met her, yeah. She worked for the Maritime Commission. She worked there for about 3 or 4 years.
So did you guys write letters while you were out there in the Pacific?
Oh, sure, yeah. We wrote back and forth, but our mail was, we didn't get mail every day. We got mail probably once a week or once every couple weeks.
And you mentioned earlier, after Iwo Jima and Okinawa, you end up in the Philippines, and that's where you found out the war was over, and that was a hallelujah day. What do you remember about that? How'd you find out, and what did everybody on your ship decide to do to celebrate?
They announced it over the loudspeaker that the Japanese had surrendered. Of course, everybody just hoot and hollered for hours, and we had a big celebration. The cooks made a bunch of food and put it together, and we had all kinds of celebrations. I don't think we went to bed till about 2 in the morning.
Was that a relief to you? Had you started to wonder if this was ever going to end?
Yeah, it was a big relief. We left the Philippines then and headed for Hawaii. We picked up a bunch of Seabees and took them back to San Francisco, I think it was. And then we were assigned to this so-called magic carpet duty, which was transporting troops back and forth. So then we took another bunch of troops back to Hawaii, and then we came back with another bunch to San Diego. And that's when I got off the ship. Of course, I was on the ship or in the service even longer than some guys, and some of the guys that were, they had this point system. If you were married, you got so many points. You had to get so many points before you could get out. Of course, I was a little disappointed because I wasn't married, and so I had to stay in longer than some of the others did, and I was a little disappointed about that. When we got back to San Diego, we went on a troop train to Chicago, and then they took off all different directions. I was discharged in Bainbridge, Maryland, 16th of December, 1945, that's not very far from Washington. So then my wife met me in the train station there in Washington, and that was a hallelujah day.
Yeah, you didn't wait very long to get married, did you?
Well, we didn't get married until the 10th of March of 46.
A whole 3 months or 4 months after you got out of the service, huh? Well, I don't want to be melodramatic, but and if there's some other close calls you remember, I'm sure we'd all like to hear about it. But do you ever sit there and say, boy, I was at Normandy, I was at Iwo Jima, I was at Okinawa. If I didn't survive all that, never would have come back to marry her. The two kids and the four grandkids and the four great-grandkids wouldn't be here. Has that ever crossed your mind?
Yeah, it has. It seems like history, though, now.
What do you think the reason for all that is? I mean, if you have those thoughts, do you feel like somebody was looking out for you, or there was a plan for your life, or is it just happenstance, or how do you make sense of that?
Oh, I thank the Lord for watching over me, I'll tell you that. Yes, I do.
Was there one moment throughout your time in the Navy that you look back and say, yeah, I really feel like God was looking out for me here?
Yeah, I think so. I think several times. Whenever we went on invasion, you never know what's going to happen. So you always kind of think back in your head, well, I wonder if I'm going to get through this or not. Or if we are. Of course, we're always thinking about the ship being sunk. That's one big thing that's in your mind, because you have these submarines with torpedoes, and you never know when one of those is going to cut loose.
And you mentioned that, and this is kind of out of left field here, but you talked about the suicide planes. A lot of people don't know there were suicide submarines as well that were basically manned torpedoes that would just ram into ships. Did you guys ever hear or see anything like that?
No, I've seen ships that were bombed from the air, like the battleship New Mexico was hit with a 500-pound bomb. As a matter of fact, it was in Hawaii when we were there. We just came from the Atlantic, and of course, those guys were telling us that you won't have a chance with that old tub that you guys are on. And anyway, we didn't say too much to them because we knew it was going to be a little rough out there. Anyway, they got fixed up after they took that 500-pound bomb and came back out there, and they got hit with a suicide plane. So you never know when something like that's going to happen.
Yeah, and in fact, that first attack you're talking about killed the New Mexico's commanding officer, as well as 29 others. The kamikaze attacks that came later, as you referenced, killed another 54. And between those two incidents, one at Luzon and the later one at Okinawa, more than 200 men aboard the New Mexico were wounded. And that was a battleship just like yours. So again, it underscores how easily it could have happened to you. Yeah, we talked about your wife a little bit, but another thing that I think reminds us, you know, as we look at our lives today, it's so hard for us to understand the reality of a worldwide war like that. But it's really about families and real people. And you had your only brother serving in the Army in Europe. Did you ever have any news about how he was doing? Did you wonder if he was going to make it home?
No, I knew he was in Germany. That's about all I knew. Nobody knew too much about their own family. My mother informed me that he was in Germany, and that's about all I knew.
When you think back about it all now, whether it's you or your brother or the guys that you knew on your ship or the guys who didn't come home from the war, what do you take pride in? What do you think the rest of us who weren't alive then need to know about your generation and what you accomplished?
Well, I don't know. After seeing those cemeteries over there, I saw a German cemetery over there that wasn't kept up to standards at all. It was just a horrible mess. And I saw the Luxembourg cemetery where Patton was buried, and it was the most beautiful thing you ever saw. That's when my wife and I went over there. I think it was in 1970, my wife and I went over there and we saw Germany and Austria and Belgium. And
doing something like that, or going to Washington, D.C. with honor flight, does it ever make you wonder what the world would look like if you guys didn't do what you did?
Well, yeah, you think about it, but what do you do? You've done your best. So.
What are you personally proud of in terms of your service to our country? What do you take pride in? What are you thankful for?
I just take pride in being in the service and doing my share. I felt that I probably done everything that I could have done. I admire all the people, and I feel sorry for all the, the guys that didn't make it. That's the whole problem. They talk about Memorial Days, and the guys that didn't make it are the ones that should be memorialed.
Was there anyone that you knew pretty well that died during the war?
Yes. I had a friend that I lived with in San Diego for a year, Phil Hafner. He was in the Army, and he was killed in Italy.
So when Memorial Day rolls around every year, that's one of the things you think about is Phil?
Yeah, I do.
Tell me about Honor Flight. What was that like for you to get on a plane with these other veterans and go see the memorial built for you and your generation?
I really enjoyed that trip. Of course, I'd been around Washington for several times, but I never had seen any of the memorials when I was. They were never built when I was there, so I really enjoyed all the memorials. The World War II memorial especially, they all impressed me.
Was there one part of it? Because, you know, I've talked to a lot of guys, and some guys find some value in finding the name of their state on the pillar, and I'm sure you saw South Dakota and California there, probably Texas, since you were on the Texas. Some guys talk about the fountains, the Wall of Gold Stars, memorializing the more than 405,000, like Phil, who didn't come home from the war, and then those little storyboards that capture different parts of the war. Was there one element of that memorial that kind of held the most meaning or most emotion for you?
Oh, probably those 4,000 gold stars. But I enjoyed all the different states. That was very impressive. The whole thing was impressive to me. Unfortunately, when I was there, the fountain wasn't working. They were having problems with the fountain. But I've seen pictures of it, so it pretty much told me what it was like.
And did it make a difference for you to experience that memorial and the other memorials there with other veterans as opposed to going by yourself?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of veterans more handicapped than I am. They were in wheelchairs, and probably some of them older than I am.
And I'm sure along the way, whether you guys were changing planes in Phoenix or somewhere or coming back here to Bakersfield, I'm sure there are a lot of people in red, white, and blue that made you feel pretty special. What was the end result of that whole experience? How did it make you feel about what you did?
Well, Phoenix was very impressive. I never shook so many hands in my life in 2 days. Those Phoenix people really came out, and even in Bakersfield here, when we landed in Bakersfield, they had a high school orchestra there, and hundreds of people there, and it was very challenging.
Challenging to keep your eyes dry?
Yeah, right.
Well, Mr. Shepherd, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us the story that only you could tell us. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think we should know about World War II and what you and all those other Americans did?
I think we covered pretty much what I was involved in.
What keeps you going? Because you're 94, but you're still driving. You're still doing yard work. Looks like you've got as much or more energy than your dog, Polly, here. What's your secret?
I don't know. Everybody tells me it's the genes. My mother and my wife's mother both were 97 when they died. My grandfather was 98. And my grandmother was 96, so maybe it is genes. But I don't know. I just take care of myself and do whatever's necessary.
Well, you're going to have to beat all of them, right? You're going to have to win that competition?
I don't know whether I'm going to beat them or not.
Well, you're a winner in my book. Willis Shepherd, 94 years old. And speaking of winners, if you've been listening to the show in recent weeks, you've heard about a contest. We honored the legacy of Louis Zamperini after he died at the beginning of July. All throughout the month, I welcomed entries, with Universal Pictures coming out with the movie version of Louis' life story, Unbroken. It'll hit theaters on Christmas Day. Universal Studios Hollywood gave me 4 theme park tickets to give away here on Hometown Heroes, so I asked you to send in what Louis Zamperini's Unbroken story means to you. A lot of you have read the book. Others just heard Louis here on the show. And I want to thank all of you who sent in your thoughts. The winning entry came from a very loyal Hometown Heroes listener who listens to the show on KNZR in Bakersfield. He's 14 years old. His name is Ethan Lockman. And here's what he wrote. I believe Louis Zamperini displayed the spirit of an American hero. That's his opening line. And Ethan continues, on pondering the definition of hero, I thought, a hero is a person admired for brave and sacrificial actions serving above and beyond the call of duty. That being said, who does not want to be like the person that they have raised up to the stature of hero? If that is true, could that person's subtitle not be role model? Yes. But what is the definition of role model? I would say it is this: one who exhibits character so just and noble that it is worthy of being followed. True heroes, whom all freedom-loving humans esteem, possess an internal passion that comes from deep inside. This passion is reflected in their actions and serves as an example for the generations to follow. Those who wrote our Constitution were the brave pioneers who founded a unique nation with liberty and justice for all. But those who, like Mr. Zamperini, defended it against its enemies in the Second World War and the other wars in which our freedoms were challenged, who answered the call of duty and who gave their all for the country that they loved, they are heroes who should be proclaimed. Now that our World War II heroes are passing so quickly, should we not aspire to be the role models for the next generation that they are to us? Mr. Zamperini displayed all the character of a true hero, not only in his service to his country, but in his example of one who continued to exhibit his true spirit in returning to the country where he was persecuted. He forgave and loved his enemies and was sincere about it. The love which he demonstrated was unmatched. He was a true American hero. We will all miss him, but we will always remember his unbroken spirit. Yeah, amen, Ethan. You know, when a 14-year-old writes something like that, it tells you our latest generation is learning something from our greatest generation, doesn't it? Ethan is also starting to interview veterans on his own, too. Music to my ears. Congratulations, Ethan, and congratulations to his homeschool teacher, his mom, Lisa. You're doing something right there. I hope you guys have an awesome time at Universal Studios Hollywood. And if you just heard that essay and you think it's something you'd like to share, I do have it posted at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time this time, but join us again next time when we meet a Native American veteran who was on Oahu on December 7th, 1941, and went on to be wounded 3 separate times during World War II, and it hasn't slowed him down one bit. I'll look forward to that conversation. And until then, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.